Illinois faces some big challenges. Today, you're about to hear a truly honest analysis of the problems we face. Equally important, you'll also hear an in-depth discussion of some practical solutions. This is your radio source for stories, insight, and the answers you won't hear anywhere else. Not in the media, and not coming from Springfield. You're listening to Illinois Rising, presented by the Illinois Policy Institute. Now, here's your host, Dan Proft.
Dan Proft, on this edition of Illinois Rising, I'm joined by Pat Hughes, the co-founder of the Illinois Opportunity Project. Of course, you can hear me Monday to Friday with Amy Jacobson on AM 560, Chicago's Morning Answer. And Pat, one of the issues that is discussed intermittently in Illinois is not just the size of state government, the expense of it, but the layers of government we have in Illinois with more local units of government than any other state in the nation by a wide margin. And so the layers upon layers of taxing bodies and thus the layers upon layers of taxes that add up to the fifth largest tax burden in the nation borne by Illinois families. And so the question is, well, okay, so we need to reduce the number of local units of government, the number of taxing bodies. So how do you do that? Is there a model that could be followed? Are there examples of township governments that have been eliminated or municipal governments that are doing something different than most other municipal governments that could perhaps be scaled? And it seems like we've got an example, not here in Illinois, but in Georgia, Sandy Springs, Georgia, which may have happened upon something that we should contemplate encouraging other municipal governments to do in Illinois.
Yeah, and I'm excited to talk to our next guest, Dan, because one of the problems with why we have so much government and so many different layers of it is the people that are in power in those different layers, they don't want to give up that power. The people who have jobs within those particular layers don't want to give up those jobs. And so it's hard to get folks to want to consolidate because the people who would be making those decisions, or at least be part of making those decisions, would be voluntarily giving up power, control, and dollars. And our next guest seems to have figured out a way to go about doing
that. Yeah, you got to protect your phony baloney jobs, but not Mayor Rusty Paul. He is the mayor of Sandy Springs, Georgia. It's a suburb of Atlanta. Mayor Paul, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Well, so Sandy Springs turns out not to be some little hamlet or some rural community. You got 100,000 people, which is about the size of our state capital in Illinois, Springfield. And the thought of Springfield doing what Sandy Springs has done is beyond the pale that I have a hard time even envisioning it. So tell us what Sandy Springs did to reduce the size of municipal government, the municipal government footprint, while still providing services to Sandy Springs residents.
Well, what we did was privatize all of our services. We went to the private sector and asked them to do theoretically what they do best, which was be innovative, creative, and figure out how to do more with less, and asked them to propose how they would run our city services, everything except for public safety. We have our own fire department and our own police department that's a traditional fire and police, but truthfully, we thought because of the liability that first responders would have that nobody could get insured for it, but we subsequently found out that we could even probably privatize fire and police, and I think if we'd known that at the time, we would have done it then too. But basically, we went to the private sector, to engineering firms, to construction firms, to technology companies, to administrative organizations, and asked them to bid on providing our services. And we received the RFPs in, and we were the first city of any size to do this. And the first time we did it, the risks were so high, really unknown. It wasn't that they were so high. It's just that the risk managers couldn't measure what the potential downside was. And we had few bidders at the time, and we ended up contracting with a large engineering company out of Denver that had a large footprint in Atlanta called CH2M Hill.
When did you do this? How long ago did you do this?
December of 2010.
December 2005. So more than a decade ago. So you've got the experience pre-privatization, and now you've got more than a decade post-privatization. What's the difference in terms of the experience of living in Sandy Springs for residents?
Well, let me make one correction. We were a new city, so we started from scratch with this model.
I see.
But we weighed what we did do was we looked at the traditional model and then the private sector model, And when we looked at the advantages and disadvantages, we chose to go the private sector route. And we've been able to drive down our costs. The last time we bid the contracts, we have a budget of about just shy of $100 million. And at the time we bid our contracts, the budget was, this was in the middle of the recession, so it was about about $85 million. And we were able to drop the cost of our basic services by about $7 million a year, or about 8 to 9% of our total budget at the time. So it's not insignificant, but more importantly, the quality of the services are very high. We do regular surveys with our citizens to measure customer satisfaction, and we get absolutely no complaints about the quality of service that we get. We get a lot of complaints about the quality of our traffic, but not about the quality of service and responsiveness of our people. And I was at a meeting this morning, and one of the county manager or one of the county employees told me what a professional group of people, how responsive our team is whenever they have an issue. And so that's fairly typical of the response that we get.
Mayor Paul, it's Pat Hughes. Thanks for being on the show with us today. You know, here in Illinois, and I'm curious as to how it is out in the Atlanta suburbs, there would be tremendous resistance to this type of model from public sector unions, from people that are in positions of power within units of government and municipalities. What has been the reaction to the surrounding communities? Is anyone looking to want to use your model and expand it, or are you running into resistance?
We've got about seven, I would think about seven cities now who've adopted some form of our model since we did it slightly over 10 years ago. Our neighboring city of Dunwoody, Johns Creek, Milton, these are cities I know that don't mean anything to your listeners, but these are suburban communities. They're slightly smaller than us, but they're not insignificant. They're cities of 40,000 people, so they're not small rural hamlets. They're ex-urban cities, and they've adopted some form of our model. Some of them have a hybrid of it, but many of them rely on the private sector to provide at least some of their services.
And just to fill in the blanks here, I mean, the numbers are rather incredible. 100,000 people in Sandy Springs. You have seven full-time municipal employees. The city's comm firm is outsourced. The engineering firm maintains the city's park. Judges are paid a flat hourly rate. So, as you said, besides police and fire, virtually everything else is outsourced. I mean, seven full-time employees in Illinois for a city of 100,000 people, you'd probably have north of 500 municipal employees and the collective bargaining agreements and all the other associated costs. Have you done any kind of comparison in terms of if you did the traditional form of municipal government, what city residents would be paying, what the expense would be as compared to this outsourcing model?
Well, we know it would be significantly higher. We haven't really sat down and analyzed it. There's no need for us to kind of look because we know that we're saving money.
Right.
We know we have a high level of satisfaction with our citizens, and we measure it. I mean, it's ongoing. We have metrics. Phone calls have to be answered in a certain period of time. Calls have to be returned in a certain period of time. We have a tracking system for every call that comes in, and the people, once it's resolved, they get an email or a text message telling them how the issue was resolved. They oftentimes get a phone call following up. So there's this, we measure our contractors on performance. As I say, I get very few. I can't think of the last time I got a complaint about the quality of service, other than when we're paving a street or closing an intersection or something that we got worked. But, we have about, that's not to say that there are only eight people working in City Hall. We have about 200 people.
Sure.
Probably not even 200. I think it's something like 100 and, just say 200. It's close enough. And they work for the private contractor delivering services. But I would say that we don't have the duplication of personnel. We get, people come to work, they're excited to be there, they're working hard because they know that this is not a jobs jobs program, it is a service program, and you're there to provide service to folks who are paying taxes, and we don't even refer to them as taxpayers. We refer to them as our customers, and we treat them as if we're a business doing, you know, providing a service to customers, we have options. And so, and when I talked to other mayors, in fact, several years ago, I was talking to a mayor in the Midwest, in one of your neighboring states. And he said, well, you know, we run our business, or we run our city like a business. I said, well, that's the difference between your city and our city. And he looked puzzled. I said, the difference between your city and our city is you run your city like a business. A business runs our city.
Very good.
And you can see the light go on because government lacks the profit motive that businesses have so that they can function like this.
Mayor Rusty Paul, he is the mayor of Sandy Springs, Georgia. Very interesting model, something we're going to try and spread around Illinois for consideration. Mayor Paul, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate your time.
We now return to Illinois Rising, presented by the Illinois Policy Institute, the radio show discussing the honest truth about Illinois policy and politics. Here's Dan Proft.
Dan Proft back with Pat Hughes, co-founder of the Illinois Opportunity Project, on this edition of Illinois Rising. And Pat, Chicago Public Schools making headlines this week, as they're wont to do, not for good reasons, as is almost always the case. Turns out Chicago Public Teachers Pension Fund, which is only about 50% funded, overpaid retirees by nearly $2.8 million in recent years because of a misrepresentation of state law. About a quarter of the money has been returned, but there's still three quarters that hasn't been. But, I mean, $2.8 million, you know, I mean, this is just a rounding error between friends. I mean, what's the big deal?
You know, Dan, as you know, and as some of our listeners know, I attended a Chicago public school when I was a kid, starting in 1975. And it's August, which means that every August there is discussion about the failure that is CPS. This is going back from when I was 6 years old. The looming possibility of a strike, right? It's never just, well, we need to pay this money back to the pension that was overpaid, or our bond rating is in the toilet, or whatever. It's always, and there's a looming strike. And that's part of the process going on here again this year, and it happens just about every year.
Well, I mean, there is some good news, I mean, in terms of improving the quality of education. Chicago Board of Education is proposing to sell nearly $1 billion in bonds for construction projects and other expenses. So there'll maybe be some new buildings. I mean, I guess it'll be the same thing going on inside those buildings. There's not so much focus on what is happening inside the buildings in terms of the quality of education in a city public school system with somewhere between 350,000 and 400,000 kids. I'd love to see that number audited, by the way.
Is Karen Lewis going to demand that the CTU build those buildings, that they actually put on construction hats and get paid for the construction? She might. That might be the next step.
I don't think they're interested in such heavy lifting, not to mention year-round work. But here's the thing about CPS. You've got three-quarters of the children in CPS who neither do reading or math at grade level in fourth and eighth grades. So we spend north of $15,000 per pupil. As you mentioned, it's the junk rated, annual $1 billion budget deficits, annual budget crunches, annual threats of strike and actual strikes not so long ago. And we just keep rinsing and repeating with the civilian leadership of the city, just kind of dismissing the possibility of a strike. And always saying, you know, we're working on it.
And
it's
Dan,
a work in progress.
New bricks and mortar, Dan, are not going to solve any of those problems. This is a structural problem based on who's in the system, who is in charge of the union, who is teaching the kids, and what their incentives are in terms of teaching the kids. And building $1 billion worth of buildings isn't going to change any of that.
All right. Well, for more on the financial side, let's bring on our friend Brian Battle. Brian Battle is the director at Performance Trust Companies. You've been studying CPS finances for a while. That's got to be very taxing work, so to speak. You find what we all find, it seems, right? The district's functionally insolvent and just continues to borrow against tomorrow to pay for yesterday and hopes that somehow things are going to turn around.
Yeah, I think that's right, Dan. Is the probably the most agonizing thing about CPS is certainly their current financial condition, in that they're running, you know, about a $5.5 billion revenue stream that they have to allocate, and they have about a $1 billion deficit. So that it's the thing that's probably most concerning is, one, that how did we end up here? Second of all, it seems that the current opinion of CPS is it's some unforeseen calamity, and this has sort of happened to CPS somehow. And the worst part is that this is all band-aiding over short-term problems, and there doesn't seem to be any recognition or any way to address the long-term.
And that's despite $750 million property tax increase is, plural, just in the last 12 months by Tiny Dancer and the city council. Now, that, of course, is not CPS. CPS is doing their own tax increases, but it's all part and parcel of the same problem of propping up this house of cards called Chicago and Chicago Public Schools.
Yeah, and so the property tax is about $250 million. It was approved by the state, and so that's an extra levy on the taxpayers of the city of Chicago. Also, CPS is planning on the state giving them $215 million, which helps plug the deficit. And they're also planning on Chicago Teachers Union cooperating in forgoing the pension payment. So in the city, 9% of a teacher's pay goes to the pension plan. And by tradition, Chicago Public Schools have been paying 7 of that 9%. So Forrest Claypool and CPS has asked Chicago Teachers Union, or has indicated, we're not going to pick up that 7% anymore, and what they've gotten in return is a threat of a strike. So I don't know if that's theater, where CTU is just sort of acting out that they have to protect their members, but it is not a foregone conclusion that two of those things will happen, that A, the state's going to send the $250 million, and B, that CTU is going to cooperate, or Chicago Teachers Union is going to cooperate and start funding have the members start funding their own pension payments.
Hey, Brian, it's Pat Hughes. Thanks for being here. I don't think that the threat over the 7% circumstance on the pension is an idle threat. I think they will potentially strike over that. Is there a policy or a set of policies that are being talked about that can be put forth that can give the parents of Chicago public school children, like my parents were for several years, hope that this financial circumstance can be abated and then turned around? Or is the structural circumstance with the unions, with the cities, what you just talked about with Dan, Mayor Emanuel, Karen Lewis, Forrest Claypool, those relationships make it impossible to reform or restructure how this thing is financed?
So there's two problems. The first is that this has taken years, and it's taken decades to get to this point in the cycle. And what we're talking about is a cycle of insolvency. I mean, and insolvency isn't like, gee, they're running out of money, and gosh, we had to do something in the future. This is a function of there's no money left in the checkbook. They made over $600 million pension payment to the teachers' pension plan this summer, and that left them with, I believe, $28 million in the bank, which covers about a day and a half worth of expenses in CPS. So it's taken a long time to get here. So Rahm Emanuel just showed up. Forrest Claypool just took the job. Certainly CTU has been consistent over the past couple of decades. So you can't lay it all at the feet of the mayor and the superintendent. However, their job is to remediate the problem and then make a long-term solution. So I think the parents and the taxpayers in the city limits have to understand it's a long-term problem. You cannot just wave a wand and say, we're going to raise taxes and fix the problem. As Dan alluded to, there's a property tax coming for CPS, and there was one coming for the city, but that $250 million isn't close to being enough. It just isn't. That's not a number that solves the problem.
So that's it. It's a long-term problem, but it's a short-term problem, too. And it seems to me, $250 million, $750 million, the teacher's pension fund alone is underfunded by about $9 billion, billion, not million, of course. So, I mean, is there any way? Governor Rauner was criticized for suggesting that bankruptcy may be a viable option for CPS to reorganize and get out from underneath some of these obligations and kind of recast their financial future, as companies do, as cities like Detroit did. Is there any realistic way to get out from underneath this financial picture that the city has created for itself and CPS has created for itself short of bankruptcy? I mean, is there any way?
So that's two questions. What CPS could do right now is change the way that they run the school system. It could be more efficient, and it's probably going to take higher taxes, expense cutting, and a reformation of the retirement system. Like starting tomorrow, if you're a new teacher in the city of Chicago, you're in a 401k. You know, first thing you do is when you have a hole, stop digging the hole. So yeah, there are things they could do right now, but the political momentum and I think just the history and tradition of the city would indicate that that's not possible. You know, it's or probable, or it's impractical. They'll never be able to do it. So I think the real answer is that there has to be the ability for Chicago Public Schools to declare bankruptcy. So let's be real careful. Bankruptcy in the municipal arena is very different than it is a corporation and for an individual, because you can't just liquidate the school system or, you know, sell the parts off or do a rehabilitation. So Chapter 9 was specifically invented in the 30s for municipalities. So you remember, during the Depression, a lot of municipalities just ceased to exist or ran out of money, and they had a horrible problem. So the first thing is Chapter 9 is reserved first just for municipalities. Secondarily, it is voluntary. Third thing is it is a petition and federal bankruptcy court. That's very important. That mm-hmm. It's a federal filing. And then so what the most important thing about a Chapter 9 bankruptcy is, one, all unsecured creditors get their contracts ripped up.
All right, Brian Battle, after that answer, I am nominating you to be to CPS what Kevin Orr was to Detroit. Brian Battle, he's the director of Performance Trust Companies. Brian, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Of course, Dan, it's not my pleasure.
Now, more of Illinois Rising, presented by the Illinois Policy Institute, the only show directly addressing the problems and solutions for Illinois. Now, here's Dan Proft.
Dan Proft back with Pat Hughes, co-founder of the Illinois Opportunity Project, on this edition of Illinois Rising. And Pat, seemed to be one issue in which there was actually bipartisan agreement in Springfield, kind of a rarity, and that is on the issue of criminal justice reform. This is also something that has been broadly spearheaded by the Illinois Policy Institute, and it mostly deals with alternative sentencing for nonviolent drug offenders and other nonviolent offenders. That's part of it, but it's an important part because Illinois' prisons are overcrowded, and some of that is a culture problem, and some of that is perhaps a management problem and an approach problem to people who have broken the law. So, for example, over the last 45 years, Illinois' prison population has gone from 7,000, rough numbers, in 1970 to 47,000 today, increased by a factor of 7, despite the population of the state only increasing by a little under 10% during that same time period. So something's going on. And in particular, we have nearly almost as many convicted murderers in prison, in Illinois prisons today, as we did total prison population in 1970. So there's certainly a culture problem and a violence in our society problem. We know this. But then there are other problems that perhaps we can improve on the margins to, number one, rehabilitate people who can be rehabilitated, reduce recidivism rates, and also lower the cost of operating our prisons in the process.
Yeah, and I think we have to look at that. And I know IPI is taking a hard look at how to go about segregating, you know, what is a violent offender who should stay in prison, obviously, and people that maybe should have some time to get out and get back into the society. What I find interesting about this is you would think it would be a bipartisan issue because of how it polls, not unlike term limits, which polls very high. But yet politicians are politicians and they're willing to play politics. And you think that Democrats, this is the typical Democrat issue, they'd be behind it. But Dan, as you know, that isn't always the case in a political season. People are willing to take whatever side will get them the win.
Well, that's right. And a number of Democrat incumbents are running scared, as they should be. One of them is John Bradley from downstate Southern Illinois, really. And he is up with a television ad attacking his Republican opponent. So that's the challenger. He's the incumbent. This was bipartisan legislation that moved in Springfield, signed by the governor, to start dealing with nonviolent drug offenders. But Bradley is up with an ad accusing his Republican challenger of, you know, opening the prison doors and letting all the violent criminals roam the streets. Here's the Bradley ad.
In Southern Illinois, we value the safety of our neighbors, friends, and families.
So why would anyone want to weaken penalties for dangerous criminals?
Dave Severin's biggest supporter wants to let 25% of the state's prisoners loose into our communities.
And Severin supports a budget plan
that puts the needs of convicted felons in prisons before critical medical services for the elderly and disabled.
Dave Severin.
He doesn't share our values.
And isn't looking out for Southern Illinois.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'm glad that little prepubescent girl is reading the state budget and commenting on it, because that's more than John Bradley's doing. But for more on this topic, we're now happy to be joined by Brian Jackson Green. He's a criminal justice policy analyst with the Illinois Policy Institute. Brian, thanks for joining us. We appreciate it. The ad that John Bradley is running and the suggestion that, in this case, Dave Severin's biggest supporter, he's obviously talking about Governor Rauner, is just opening the prison doors and allowing all the violent criminals out to do whatever they want.
That's a complete lie. I mean, Governor Rauner's goal is to reduce the prison population over 10 years, but it's not being done simply by opening the doors and letting a quarter of people out. I mean, if you want to do that, it obviously wouldn't take 10 years. What's happening is that there's a concerted effort at reform, largely by getting a lot of drug users or people with drug addiction into treatment programs instead of going to prison, and then later on perhaps overhaul sentencing so that many people won't be in prison for quite as long as they have been, and also removing barriers to work and employment that get a lot of people getting full-time, well-paying jobs instead of turning back to crime and returning to prison. But no, to say that he's just opening the door and releasing people is not true.
Hey, Brian, it's Pat. Thanks for being on. How do you message this issue to folks that Bradley's ad is targeting, who are concerned about people leaving prison, right? They don't specifically know enough information to sort of delineate between violent and nonviolent, between a drug user and a drug dealer. How do you message to folks so that this issue stays popular and so that they realize that the people that would be left out of prison and into these programs are not going to offend again or are not going to be harmful to the people in the community?
Well, it's all about presenting alternatives, basically, to sentencing right now. So I think most people get, and we've done some polling on this, that someone who has a chronic drug addiction problem that causes them either just to use drugs or to commit crimes to fund the drug addiction need help. Most people are sympathetic to these people. They don't really see it as something that just needs punishment, but they sort of want them to get better because a lot of people are noticing it's their brothers, sisters, relatives that are going through these issues. So if you frame it in terms of treatment and accountability instead of simply locking someone away and throwing away the key, then people, even Republicans, are seeming to get that it's about actually helping people to reform rather than being soft on crime or weak on crime.
Well, and just to be specific here, we're not talking about releasing rapists and murderers and habitual violent offenders.
No, and those groups aren't at all really being discussed in the reform conversation. What we're talking about are people who, many people who are drug users, many people who might be low-level property offenders where, say, a shorter sentence or more effective intervention would be effective, but no one who would be considered a serious violent offender.
All right. He is Brian Jackson Green, criminal policy analyst with the Illinois Policy Institute. Brian, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Now, more stories, insights, and analysis of Illinois policy and politics. This is Illinois Rising, presented by the Illinois Policy Institute. Once again, your host, Dan Proft.
Dan Proft back with Pat Hughes, co-founder of the Illinois Opportunity Project, on this edition of Illinois Rising. And Pat, it's interesting. We've had a second state legislator weigh in on the topic of legislative pay. In other words, they should get paid, even as we're nearing $10 billion in unpaid bills to state vendors and social service provider bills that have been waiting for the resources so that Comptroller Munger can cut the checks to those individuals and organizations that have provided goods or services to the state. And I would suggest that perhaps members of the General Assembly have been not providing anything that could be legitimately called a good or a service to the state. But that hasn't stopped State Representative Rob Martwick. He's another scion of a political hack out in West Central Cook County, Norridge area. Following on Kimberly Lightford, the senator from Maywood, West Central Cook County, who chastised Comptroller Munger on the Senate floor, saying, essentially, we're legislators, we're working, we should get paid, we should be at the front of the line. To hell with anybody else who's owed money. That's not our problem, even though actually, by definition, it is their problem. And so Martwick said the same thing, calling the delay of lawmaker pay, being for having state lawmakers put in the queue with everybody else, just like everybody else who's owed money from the state and hasn't received it yet, putting them in the queue as it pertains to their pay, which they'll ultimately get, but they're going to have to wait like everybody else. As I said, Martwick called that a corruption of our democracy. What of that?
Well, there are two groups of people, Dan, who want to get paid for not doing anything that's particularly important. One group is state legislators because they're not doing their job. The other group is radio hosts. I don't know if you know that. That's the other group that wants to get paid for not doing very much.
Fully funded. Here.
Yeah, I understand that. Well, look, the legislators should be treated like the other people who aren't getting paid. I think Comptroller Munger made a major statement on this at the state fair yesterday and afterwards, and I think she's right. Look, people in the state are suffering. Taxpayers are suffering with higher property taxes. Jobs are fleeing the state. Vendors of the state of Illinois have to wait in line, like you said, to be paid. And legislators should be treated in that same manner. And actually, they should be treated with a little bit more temerity than that, because they're part of the problem, a huge part of the problem, why this issue isn't resolved. So what I say to them, and I think this is what Comptroller Munger is saying, but I won't speak for her, is go to work, get something done for the people of the state of Illinois that you get paid to help for your $75,000, $85,000, $90,000 for part-time work and full pensions, and go do something to help our state improve. If you're not going to do that, then wait in line to get paid.
Well, and also what Comptroller Munger has unveiled is an idea that she's asking legislators to consider. So kind of a litmus test for those who are serious about taking a hit like everybody else is taking until they can collectively come together to stop dishing out hits and start cutting checks, that if you don't pass a constitutionally balanced budget, as is required, then you don't get paid at all.
It sounds
and that can be done legislatively, prospectively, if the General Assembly. So it's a way to kind of put legislators to the test. We haven't had a constitutionally balanced budget in 15 years, and it shows by our balance sheet. So if you're serious about this, legislator, individual legislator, every single one of the 177, then sign on to legislation that says if we don't do our job, which is to pass a balanced budget on an annualized basis, then we don't get paid at all.
This dovetails, Dan, into our prior segment with Mayor Paul outside of Atlanta, right? If these folks, if these legislators were held accountable for not doing their job, like a contractor would, like a real employee would, then they would do their job. But they're not being held accountable. It's not any different than the teachers in the Chicago Teachers Union, right? They're not being held accountable for not doing their job. And all they want is their pay and their benefits, right? And that's what they continue to want. And they're so privileged. They're so entitled that they can't see the difference between what they get and what they're getting and what the rest of us have to do to get anything, and how we are the ones financing their circumstance and their largesse. And it's really off-putting. So I'm very happy that the comptroller is standing up on this issue.
Yeah, I remember this conversation I had with Kate Cloonan, who's a Democrat rep from the Kankakee Bourbonnais area. A couple of years ago at a dinner I spoke at, I was criticizing legislative pay and suggesting that $75,000 is plus you vest for a pension after 8 years plus the health insurance benefits for part-time work is too much, particularly since it's considerably more than all of our Midwestern neighbors. Per capita, it's the highest in the nation. And I compare that to Texas, where they get a modest stipend and they meet once every 2 years. And let's compare the economic performance of Illinois to Texas, and which one has the political professional class. But I was accosted by Representative Cloonan after this speech because she said, you know, how dare you? You know, get your facts straight. I don't make $75,000. I make $67,000. I said, oh, well, but please, next time you hear me say something so egregiously incorrect, stand up. Stand up and tell everybody here, tell the assembled, I don't make $75,000. I make $67,000. Now, that's before any bumps she gets from committee assignments, but let's just take her at that face. Tell them how hard you work and you only make $67,000. Oh, and we don't, you know, it used to be you vest for a pension after 4 years. Well, they bumped that all the way up to 8 years. Well, who in the private sector vests for a pension after 8 years?
Well, this is how craven and how entitled and how ensconced in her own world she is, because the people in that room that you were talking to that night, I bet you
Only a small percentage
of those people would make over $60,000. And here's the thing: I'm a little bit different on this. Is that I don't care if they get paid $67,000 or $75,000. I don't care. That's fine if they go and do a job. If they go and accomplish something for the people that elect them, that pay their salaries. If they do that, that's the American way. I don't care that they get removed from their families and they go down there and get paid. It's getting paid for nothing.